Your father said immediately, "This is the one." We'd seen so many since I had been going with him on these searches for quite a while, but this one he liked at first sight. Was it last year? No, no, it was nearly 3 years ago. Then I had to find the owners and persuade them to sell. Nobody ever sells anything up here. It's okay to keep a ruin for your entire lifetime, but not to sell it to someone who might actually do something with it.
And what did he want to do with it?
Build a house.
A house?
Sure. My father always hated houses. Well, it seems like he changed his mind.
Meanwhile, it had started to rain. I felt a drop on the back of my hand and saw that it was halfway between rain and snow. Even the sky seemed undecided between winter and spring. The sky hid the mountains and divested things of their mass, but even on such a morning as this I could sense the beauty of this place. A somber, bitter beauty, communicating awesome power rather than tranquility, as well as a degree of anguish. The beauty of the reverse side.
"Does it have a name, this place?" I asked.
"Yes, I think so. According to my mother, it was once called Barmadrola. She's never wrong about such things. She remembers all the names."
"So the Barma is that rock over there?"
"That's right."
"And the Drola?"
"That means strange."
"Strange because it's so white?"
"I think yes."
"The strange rock," I said, to hear what it sounded like. I stayed sitting there for a while to look around me and to reflect on the meaning of this inheritance. My father, the same person who had fled from houses all his life, had cultivated a desire to build one up here. He hadn't been able to do so, but imagining his own death, he had thought of leaving the place to me. Who knows what he wanted from me?
Bruno said, "I'm available for the summer."
"Available for what?"
"To work, no?"
And since I did not seem to understand, he explained, "Your father designed the house the way he wanted it, and he made me promise that I would build it. He was sitting right where you're sitting now when he asked me." The revelations kept on coming. The map of the routes, the red and the green that accompanied the black, and I thought that there were many other things that Bruno had yet to tell me. As for the house, if my father had arranged everything in this way, I saw no reason not to observe his wishes. Except for one, that is. "But I don't have any money," I said. My inheritance had already been used up settling my disastrous finances. There was a little left, but hardly enough to build a house with, and I didn't feel like using it for this. I had a long list of deferred wishes to fulfill. Bruno nodded. He had expected this objection. He said, "All that we need to do is buy the materials, and even on them I think it's possible to save quite a bit." "Fine, but who is going to pay you for doing the work?"
"Don't worry about me. This isn't the kind of job you expect to get paid for."
He did not explain to me what he meant, and just as I was about to ask him, he added, "It would be useful to have someone to lend a hand. With a laborer, I'd be able to finish it in 3 or 4 months. What do you say? Are you up for it?" Down in the plains, I would have laughed at the suggestion. I would have answered that I didn't know how to do anything, and that I would have been of no help whatsoever. But I was sitting on a wall in the middle of the snow, facing a frozen lake at an altitude of 2,000 meters. I had begun to feel a sense of inevitability. For reasons unknown to me, my father had wanted to bring me here, to this clearing pummeled by landslides beneath that strange rock, to work together with this man on these ruins. "Okay, Dad," I said to myself. "Set me another riddle. Let's see what you've prepared for me. Let's see what else there is to learn."
3 or 4 months? I asked.
"Oh, sure."
"When do you want to start, then?"
"As soon as the snow melts," Bruno replied. Then he jumped down from the wall and began to explain to me how he thought it should be done.
Six. The snow disappeared quickly that year. I returned to Grana at the beginning of June, at the height of the thawing season, with the water swelling the river and coursing down from everywhere in the valley, forming short-lived waterfalls and streams which I had never seen before. It seemed as if you could feel it beneath your feet, that snowmelt from the mountains, and even 1,000 meters lower down it rendered the earth as soft as moss. As for the rain that fell daily, we decided to ignore it. One Monday morning at dawn we took from Bruno's house a spade, a pickaxe, a large hatchet, a chainsaw, and half a tank of petrol, and with all this gear on our backs we climbed up to my property, to Barma, as we had begun to call it. Although he was carrying the heavier load, I was the one who had to stop every quarter of an hour to get my breath back. I would put down the rucksack and sit on the ground, all the errors that my father had once taught me to avoid, and we would stay there in silence, avoiding each other's gaze while my heart slowed down. Up above, the snow had given way to mud and dead grass, allowing me to better assess the state that the ruins were in. The walls seemed solid enough, up to about 1 meter of their height, thanks to cornerstones that even the two of us together could not have shifted. But for 1 meter above that, the long wall was leaning outwards, pushed by the beams of the roof before it collapsed, and the short walls were completely unstable, with the last course of stones hanging on precariously at the height of a man. Bruno said that we would have to demolish them almost down to the base. It would be useless to try to straighten skewed walls. Much better to simply throw them down and start from scratch. But first we had to prepare the building site. It was 10 a.m. when we entered the ruin and began to free it of all the collapsed rubble inside. This was mostly made up of shingles that had once been the tiles of the roof, but also of the old flooring that divided the ground floor from the first, and in the midst of all this sodden wood there were beams of 6 or 7 meters in length, still jammed into the walls or stuck in the ground. Some had withstood exposure, and Bruno checked to see if they could be reused. We labored a good deal extracting the sound ones and dragging them outside, rolling them beyond the walls on 2 inclined planks, while the spoiled ones were split and stored away as firewood. Because of his truncated fingers, Bruno had learned how to use a chainsaw left-handed. He held the wood down with his foot and worked with the tip of the blade, cutting very close to his boot sole and raising a cloud of sawdust behind him. The pleasant smell of burnt wood perfumed the air. Then the piece he was cutting off would fall, and I would collect it for stacking. I soon got tired. I was still less used to working with my arms than with my legs. At midday we came out of the ruins covered in dust and sawdust. There were 4 fine larch trunks beneath the big rock wall, cut down 1 year ago and left there to season. When the time came, they would become the beams of the new roof, but for now I used one to sit on. "I'm worn out already," I said, "and we haven't even started yet." "We've started all right," Bruno said. "We'll need 1 week just to clear up, and to demolish the walls and to clear the ground around here." "We might do. Who knows?" In the meantime, we had made a fireplace with stones and lit a small fire with the wood chips for kindling. As hot and sweaty as I was, it was still pleasurable to dry myself in front of a fire. I rummaged in my pockets, found the tobacco, and rolled a cigarette. I offered the packet to him, and he said, "I don't know how. If you do it for me, I'll try one." When I lit it, he tried hard not to cough. I could see that he wasn't a smoker. "Have you been a smoker for long?" he asked. "I started one summer when I was here, so how old must I have been, 16 or 17? "Really? I never saw you smoke." "Because I smoked in secret. I would go into the woods so as not to be seen, or up onto the roof of the house."
"And who were you hiding from? From your mother?"
"I don't know. I would just hide, that's all." Bruno sharpened the ends of 2 small sticks with his penknife. He took some sausage from his rucksack, cut it into pieces, and put them to grill. He also had bread, a black loaf, from which he cut 2 large chunks and gave 1 to me. He said,
"Look, it doesn't matter how long it takes. If you try to think too far ahead with this kind of work, it'll drive you nuts."
"So what should I think about?"
"About today. Look what a beautiful day it is."
I looked around. You needed a degree of optimism to describe it in such terms. It was one of those days in late spring when the wind is always gusting in the mountains. Banks of clouds came and went, blocking the sun, and the air was still cold, as if an obstinate winter was refusing to make its departure. Down below, the lake looked like black silk rippled by the wind. But actually no, it was the other way round. The wind was like an icy hand smoothing out the movements on its surface.
I felt like stretching my own out towards the fire to steal from it a little of its heat. In the afternoon, we continued to extract the rubble until we reached the floor of the ruin, planking which clearly showed the nature of the building. On one side, against the long wall, we found the feeding troughs, while a small gutter in the dead center of the room served as a drain for the manure. The floor was made of planks the width of 3 fingers, polished by years of contact with the muzzles and hooves of beasts. Bruno said that we could clean them up and use them to build something else, and began to lever them out with the pickaxe. I noticed something on the floor and picked it up. It was a wooden cone, smooth and hollow, similar to the horn of an animal. "That's used with a scythe stone," Bruno said when I showed it to him. "A scythe stone?" "A stone for sharpening the blade. There's probably another word for it, but who knows what it is anymore. I should ask my mother. I think it's a river stone."
"From the river?"
I felt like a child to whom everything has to be explained. He showed infinite patience with these questions of mine. He took the horn from my hand and held it to his side, then explained. "The scythe stone is a smooth, round stone, almost black. It has to be wet to work properly. You hang this from your belt with a little water inside, so that every so often, while you are scything, you can moisten the stone and sharpen the blade like this." He made a sweeping, soft gesture with his arm, describing a half moon above his head. I could see perfectly the imaginary scythe and the imaginary stone that was sharpening it. Only then did I realize that we were repeating one of our favorite games. I don't know why it hadn't occurred to me before, since we had been in so many ruins just like this one. We would get in through holes in walls that were in danger of collapse. We walked on planks that moved beneath our feet. We would steal a few wrecked items and pretend that they were treasures. We had done it for years. So I began to see the project on which we were embarked in a slightly different light. Until then, I had believed that I was only there for my father's sake, to fulfill his wishes, to assuage my guilt. But at that moment, watching Bruno sharpening the imaginary scythe, the inheritance I'd received seemed more like a compensation or a second chance for our interrupted friendship. Was that what my father had wanted to give me? Bruno took one last look at the horn and tossed it onto the pile of wood set aside for burning. I went over to retrieve it and put it away, thinking that I would find some future use for it. I did the same with the Swiss pine that had managed to grow in the middle of the ruin. At 5, when I was too tired to do anything else, I used the pickaxe to dig around the little tree and extricate it with its roots still intact. Its trunk was thin and twisted due to its efforts to reach the light from out amongst the rubble. With its roots exposed, it looked moribund, and I hurried to replant it nearby. I dug a hole at the edge of the clearing, planting it where there was the best view of the lake, treading down firmly the earth that I used to cover its roots. But when I left it there, in the wind to which it was not accustomed, it was blown from side to side. Exposed to the elements from which it had long been protected, it looked like an altogether too fragile creation. "Do you think it will make it?" I asked.
"Who knows?" said Bruno. "It's a strange plant, that one. Strong where it decides to grow, and weak if you put it somewhere else."
"Have you tried before?"
"A few times."
"How did it work out?"
"Badly."
He looked at the ground, the way he did when thinking again about some old story. "My uncle wanted a Swiss pine in front of the house. I don't know why, maybe he thought it would bring him good luck. And he sure needed it, no doubt about that. So every year he would send me to the mountain to get a sapling. But it always ended up getting trampled by the cows, and after a while we stopped trying."
"What do you call it here?"
"The Swiss pine?
Arula."
"That's it.
And it brings good luck?"
"So they say. Perhaps it does if you believe it."
Whether lucky or not, I felt attached to that young tree. I sunk a stout stick next to its trunk and attached it at several points with twine. Then I went to the lake to fill a drinking bottle to water it with. When I got back, I saw that Bruno had constructed a kind of low platform beneath the big wall. He had put on the ground 2 of the old roof beams and nailed on a few salvaged planks. Then he took from the rucksack a small rope and a rainproof sheet of the kind used in Grana to protect the hay in the fields. With 2 wooden stakes, he attached 2 corners of the sheet to a crack in the rock and attached the other 2 to the ground, thus making a kind of shelter beneath which he put the rucksack and provisions.
Are we leaving this stuff there? I asked. We're not leaving it. I'm staying there too.
What do you mean you're staying?
I mean that I'm sleeping here.
Sleeping there?
This time he lost patience and replied brusquely,
I can't just lose 4 working hours a day, can I? A builder stays on site Monday to Saturday. The laborer goes back and forth with the materials. That's how it's done.
I looked at the bivouac that he'd constructed. Now I understood why his rucksack had been so full.
And you want to sleep in there for 4 months?
3 months, 4 months, whatever it takes. It's summer. On Saturday I can go down and sleep in a bed.
So shouldn't I stay here too?
Maybe later. There are still a lot of materials to bring up. I've borrowed a mule.
Bruno had thought long and hard about the work that was before us. I was improvising. He certainly wasn't. He had planned every phase, both my tasks and his, all the various stages and a timetable for them. He explained where the material had been prepared and what I would have to bring up to him the next day. His mother would show me how to load the mule. He said,
I'll expect you at 9 in the morning. At 6 you'll be free to go. If it's all right by you, that is.
Of course it's all right by me.
Do you think you can do it?
Sure.
Good on you. So I'll be seeing you then.
I looked at the time. It was 6:30. Bruno took a towel and a bar of soap and headed uphill to wash at some place that he knew. I looked over the ruin, which seemed just the same as we'd found it that morning, except that now it was empty inside, and outside of it there was a fine stack of wood. I thought that it wasn't bad for a first day's work. Then I took my rucksack, said goodbye to my tree, and began walking towards Grana. There was an hour that I loved more than any other in this month of June, and it was precisely the one during which I descended alone at the end of the day. In the morning it was different. I was in a rush. The mule would not take my orders. My only thought was to get up there. In the evening, instead, there was no reason to hurry. I left at 6 or 7, with the sun still high in the bottom of the valley, and with no one expecting me at home. I walked calmly, with my thoughts slowed by tiredness, and the mule following behind me without needing any prompting from me. From the lake down to the landslide, the rhododendrons were in bloom on the flanks of the mountain. At the Guglielmina farmstead, around the deserted buildings, I startled roe deer foraging in the abandoned pastures. Bolt upright, with their ears at attention, they would look at me in alarm for an instant, then flee to the woods like thieves. Sometimes I stopped there for a smoke. While the mule grazed, I would sit on the larch tree stump where the photo of Bruno and me had been taken. I would contemplate the farmstead and the strange contrast between the entropy of human things and the resurgence of spring. The 3 buildings were falling into decline, their walls curving like elderly backs, their roofs succumbing to the weight of winters, while everywhere around them was awash with burgeoning herbs and flowers. I would like to have known what Bruno was doing at that time. Had he lit the fire, or was he walking alone towards the mountain, or did he keep working until dark? In many ways, the man that he had become surprised me. I had expected to find, if not the double of his father, then that of one of his cousins, or of the bricklayers I used to see him with at the bar. Instead, he had nothing at all in common with these people. He seemed to me like someone who, at a certain point in life, had given up on the company of others, that he had found a corner of the world and retreated into it. He reminded me of his mother. I often came across her in those days when I was loading up of a morning. She showed me how to fasten the pack saddle, how to secure the planks or the tools on the flanks of the mule, how to goad him on when he refused to budge. But she had not uttered a word about my return or about the work that I was doing with her son. Ever since I was a child, it seemed that nothing in our lives was of interest to her, that she was happy in her own place and that other people passed by her like the seasons. I wondered, though, whether she did not conceal feelings of an altogether different kind. I would take the path along the river, and, reaching Grana, would tie the mule up next to the house, light a fire, and put a saucepan of water on to boil. If I'd remembered to buy one, I would open a bottle of wine. In the larder I had only pasta, conserves, and a few tins for emergencies. After the first 2 glasses, I felt completely exhausted. Sometimes I would throw in the pasta and fall asleep while it was cooking and find it later that night, the stove gone out, the bottle half-drunk, my supper reduced to an inedible mess. So I would open a tin of beans and devour them with a spoon without even bothering to tip them from the tin. Then I would stretch out on my mattress beneath the table, zip myself into the sleeping bag, and instantly fall back into a deep sleep. Towards the end of June, my mother arrived with a friend. Her friends were taking turns keeping her company throughout the summer, though she did not seem to me to have the air of an inconsolable widow. Yet she told me herself that she was happy to have someone close to her, and I noticed the silent intimacy that she shared with this other woman. They spoke together infrequently in my presence, understanding each other with a glance. I saw them sharing the old house with a mutual ease that was more precious than words. After the meager funeral of my father, I thought a lot about his loneliness, that kind of perpetual conflict between himself and the rest of the world. He had died in his car without leaving a single friend to mourn his absence. But with my mother, I could see the fruits of a long life spent cultivating relationships, caring for them like the flowers on her balcony. I wondered if you learn and develop such a talent, or whether you just have it or not at birth. Whether there was still time for me to learn. So now when I came down the mountain, I found not just one, but two women to care for me. The table laid, clean sheets on the bed, no more sleeping bag and beans. After supper, my mother and I would linger in the kitchen to talk. Such talk came easily to me with her, and on one occasion I told her that it was like going back to old times there together, only to discover that her own memories of those evenings we shared were quite different from mine. In her mind, I had hardly ever spoken. She remembered me as absorbed in a world of my own that it was impossible to penetrate, and from which she rarely received any communication. She was only too happy now to have the opportunity to make up some ground between us. At Barma, Bruno and I had begun to build the walls. I described to my mother the way in which we were working, since she seemed keen to hear about what I was learning as a laborer. Each wall was actually made of two parallel rows of stones, separated by a space which we filled with smaller ones. Every so often a large stone was put in place across the gap, joining the two rows together. We used cement as little as possible, not for ecological reasons, but because I had to carry it up there in sacks, each weighing 25 kilos. We would mix the cement with sand from the lake and would pour the mixture between the stones so that from the outside it could hardly be noticed. For many days I had been going back and forth between Barma and the lake with the sand. There was a small beach on its far shore where I would fill the mule's saddlebags. I really liked the idea that it was this sand that was holding the house together. My mother listened carefully, but she was not really interested in the carpentry. "So how are you getting on with Bruno?" she asked. "It's strange. Sometimes I feel like I've known him forever, but then I think that I know next to nothing about him." "What's so strange about it?" "The way that he speaks to me. He's very kind to me. More than kind, actually. He's affectionate. I didn't remember that side of him. It always strikes me as something I don't really understand." I threw a piece of wood into the stove. I felt like having a cigarette, but I was embarrassed to smoke in front of my mother, and even though I would have liked to rid myself of that stupid secret, I couldn't bring myself to do so. I went to pour myself a little grappa instead. Grappa was different. There was no embarrassment involved. When I sat back down, my mother said, "Well, you know, Bruno was very close to us during these years. At certain times he was here every evening. Dad helped him a lot."
"Helped him in what way?"
"Not in a practical sense. How can I put it? Yes, on occasion he did lend him money, but that wasn't it. At a certain point, Bruno fell out with his own father. He never wanted to work with him again. I think he didn't even see him for years. So if he needed any advice, he would come here. He had real faith in what your father had to say."
"I didn't know that. And he always asked after you, how you were, what you were up to. I told him what you had written in your letters. I never stopped giving him news about you."
"I didn't know that," I repeated. I was finding out what happens to the person who leaves. Life goes on for the others without him. I imagined their evenings together when Bruno was 20 years old, 25 years old, and was there in my place, talking with my father. Maybe it would not have happened if I had stayed, or perhaps we would have shared those moments. More than jealousy, I felt regret for not having been there. I felt as if I had missed out on important things, busying myself with others so inconsequential that I could hardly remember what they were. We finished the walls and went on to construct the roof. It was already July when I went to the blacksmith in the village to collect the 8 steel brackets that Bruno had ordered, made to his own design, together with a few dozen foot-long expansion screws. I loaded these materials onto the mule, together with a small generator, some more petrol, and my old climbing gear. Once everything had been delivered, I went to the top of the rock wall, where I had never been before then. There were 4 larch trees up there. I secured myself to one of the biggest and lowered myself halfway down using a double rope, armed with an electric drill. Then spent the rest of the day between the instructions shouted by Bruno from below, the humming of the generator, and the deafening shriek of the drill as it penetrated the rock. 4 screws were necessary for each bracket, which meant 32 holes in all. According to Bruno, these numbers were crucial. The whole viability of the roof depended on them. In the winter, the rock would constantly shed snow, and he had thought long and hard about the specifications in order to construct a roof that could withstand these blows. Several times I pulled myself up the rope, shifted the anchor point a bit further on, and slid back down to where he was indicating to drill the rock. Towards evening, the 8 brackets had all been fixed in place, aligned at regular intervals of 4 meters in height. Our days would end with the beer that I now squeezed into the rucksack in the morning along with our provisions. We sat down in front of the fireplace that was blackened by ash and embers. I, in contrast to it, was white, covered in dust, hands aching from using the rock drill. I was proud that Bruno had decided to entrust me with that work. "The problem with snow is that you never know how heavy it might get," he said. "There are calculations with which you can work out the load borne, but it's best to double everything."
"What calculations?"
"Well, a cubic meter of water weighs 10 quintals, right? Snow can weigh between 3 and 7, depending on how much air it contains. So if a roof was to withstand snow to a depth of 2 meters, you would have to allow for a weight of 14 quintals. I double it."
"So how did they used to work that out in the past?"
"In the past, they used to shore everything up. In the autumn, before leaving. They would fill the house with poles reinforcing the roof. Remember those short, thick trunks that we found? But it looks as if one winter even the poles failed to do the job, or who knows, perhaps they forgot to put them in place properly."
I looked at the tops of the walls. I tried to imagine the snow that had accumulated up there suddenly becoming detached and falling. It was some fall.
"Your father really enjoyed discussing this kind of problem."
"Oh, really?
How wide a plank needs to be, at what distance from each other they need to be spaced, what is the best wood to use? Pine isn't right because it's too soft. Larch is stronger." It wasn't enough for him to be told what was to be used. He always wanted to know the reasons behind everything. "The fact is that one grows in the shade, the other in the sun. It's the sun that hardens the wood. Shade and water make it soft and unsuitable for beams."
"Yes. I can believe that he liked to know such things.
He had even bought himself a book. I would tell him, 'Don't bother, Gianni. We can go and ask some old builder.' I took him to see my old boss once. We took our plans to him, and your father brought along a notebook in which he wrote everything down. Though I suspect that afterwards he went to double-check everything with his book, since he didn't trust people much, did he?"
"I don't know," I said. "I think he did."
I hadn't heard my father's name since the day of the funeral. I was glad to hear it uttered by Bruno, even though it seemed to me at times that we had known 2 altogether different people.
"Are we raising the beams tomorrow?" I asked.
"First, we've got to cut them to size, and shape them to fit the brackets. To lift them, we'll need the mule. Let's see how it goes."
"Do you think it will take a long time?"
"I don't know. One thing at a time, no? First, the beer."
"Okay, first the beer." In the meantime, I had been getting back in shape. After a month of taking the road down every morning, I was beginning to rediscover my former speed. It seemed to me that the grass in the fields along the way was getting thicker each day, the river water calmer, the green of the larches more vivid, and that for the woods, the arrival of summer was like the end of a turbulent adolescence.
It was also the period in which I used to arrive as a boy. The mountain took on again the aspect with which I was most familiar, from the time when I thought that the seasons hardly changed up there, and that there was a permanent summer awaiting my return. In Grana, I would find the workers preparing the stables, moving things around with tractors. In a few days' time, they would take the herds up, and the lower reaches of the valley would be repopulated again. Now nobody would be going higher anymore. There were another two ruins near the lake, not far from the road that I used going to and fro. The first, besieged by nettles, was in the same state as I had found my own property in the spring. But the roof had only partially collapsed, and taking a look inside, I found the same sad spectacle. Its one small room had been vandalized, as if the owner had wanted, on leaving it, to take revenge for the miserable life lived there, or as if successive visitors had searched fruitlessly for anything of value. There remained a table, a wonky stool, crockery thrown amongst the rubbish, and a stove that still looked good to me and that I intended to go back and salvage before everything was buried under another collapse. The second ruin, on the other hand, was barely the memory of a much older and more sophisticated building. The first could not have been more than 100 years old. This one must have been built at least 3 centuries ago. It wasn't a simple, small stable building, but a large alpine farmstead made up of separate structures, almost like an entire small village, with external stone staircases and roof beams of mysteriously imposing dimensions. Mysterious, because the trees big enough to make them grew hundreds of meters lower down, and I couldn't imagine how they had been carried there. There was nothing left inside the houses except the walls that remained standing, scoured by the rain. Compared to the shacks I was familiar with, these ruins seemed to speak of a more aristocratic civilization that had exhausted itself in a period of decadence before becoming extinguished altogether. Going up, I liked to stop for a moment on the shore of the lake. I would bend down to touch the water and test the temperature with my hand. The sun, which illuminated the summits of the Grenon, had not yet reached the basin, and the lake still had a nocturnal aspect, like a sky no longer dark, but not yet light. I could no longer remember clearly why I had distanced myself from the mountain or what else I had found to love when I had ceased to love it there. But it seemed to me, going back up alone every morning, that I had gradually begun to make my peace with it. In those July days, Barmer resembled a sawmill. I had delivered various loads of planks, and now the terrace was crowded with stacked wood, 2-meter-long planks of pine still white and perfumed with resin. The 8 beams were suspended between the rock face and the long wall, fixed to the iron brackets, inclined at 30 degrees and supported in the middle by a long beam of larch. Now that the skeleton of the roof was in place, I could imagine the finished house. Its door faced west, and it had 2 fine north-facing windows that looked towards the lake. Bruno had wanted them to be arched, losing entire days shaping with mallet and chisel the stones that surrounded them. Inside there would be 2 rooms, 1 per window. From the 2 floors of the old building, with the stable below and living room above, we wanted to make only 1 that would be taller and more spacious. Though it proved beyond me as yet, I would sometimes try to visualize the light that would come into it. On arriving, I would rekindle the embers in the fireplace by throwing in a few dry twigs, fill a small pan with water, and put it on the fire. From the rucksack, I would take out fresh bread and a single tomato, one of those that Bruno's mother had managed to grow miraculously at an altitude of 1,300 meters. In search of the coffee, I would poke my head inside the bivouac and find the sleeping bag disheveled, a candle stump melted onto a plank, a half-open book. Glancing at the cover, I smiled at seeing the name of its author, Conrad. From all the schooling that my mother had given him, Bruno had retained a passion for novels about the sea. He would come out of the house as soon as the smell of the fire reached him. He was in there measuring and cutting the rafters for the roof. He looked wilder as the week progressed, and if I had lost my sense of time, I could tell what day of the week it was by the length of his stubble. At 9, he was already deep into his work, absorbed by thoughts from which he would only emerge with difficulty. "Oh," he would say, "you're here." He would raise his hand and give me his truncated salute, then join me for breakfast. With his knife, he would cut a chunk of bread and a slice of toma. The tomato he ate as it was, without cutting it and without salt or anything else, staring at the building site and thinking about the work that lay ahead.
7. It was the season of return and of reconciliation, two words I thought about frequently as the summer ran its course. One evening my mother told me a story about herself, my father, and the mountain, about the way in which they had met and ended up marrying. It was odd to be hearing about it so late, given that it was the story of how our family originated and therefore of how I came to be born. But when a boy, I was too young for this kind of story, and after that had stopped wanting to hear. At 20, I would have put my hands over my ears rather than listen to family reminiscences, and even on this evening my first reaction was one of reluctance. Yet one side of me looked with affection on these things that were unknown to me. As I listened, I gazed out at the opposite flank of the valley, in the penumbra of 9 in the evening. It was thick with fir trees on that side, a wood without clearings that descended emphatically all the way to the river. Only a long gorge cut through it with a lighter line, and it was this that held my eye. As my mother's story unfolded, I began to feel something quite different. I know this story already, I thought. And it was true that in my own way I did know it. For years I had collected fragments of it, like someone who possesses pages torn from a book and has read them thousands of times in random order. I had seen photographs, listened to conversations. I had observed my parents and their way of dealing with things. I knew which arguments ended abruptly in silence, which others were drawn out, and which names from the past had the power to sadden or to move them. I had all the elements of the story at my disposal, but had never managed to reconstruct the narrative in its entirety. After I had been looking outside for a while, I saw the does that were waiting there on the other side. In the gorge there must have been a vein of water, and every evening, just before dark, they would leave the wood to drink from it. From this distance I could not see the water, but the deer showed that it was there. They came and went along their own track, and I watched them until it was too dark to see anything anymore. This was the story. In the 50s, my father was the best friend of my mother's brother, my uncle Piero. They had both been born in 1942 and were 5 years younger than she was. They had met as children on the campsite to which the village priest would take them. In the summer, they would spend a whole month in the Dolomites. They slept in a tent, played in the woods, learned how to be in the mountains and to fend for themselves. And this was the life that made them such close friends. "I could understand that, no?" my mother said. Yes, it was not at all difficult to imagine them. Piero did extremely well at school. My father had stronger legs and a stronger character. Actually, though, the contrast was not so simple. In some respects, my father was the more fragile of the two, and he was also the one who could touch others with his enthusiasm. He was the most imaginative as well as the most restless. His high spirits when in company were infectious, and partly because of this, partly because he was living at boarding school, he soon became a regular at my mother's home. To her, he had seemed like a boy with too much energy to burn, like someone who needed to run faster than others in order to use it up. The fact that he was an orphan counted for nothing in those days. It was so common after the war, just as it was common to take in somebody else's son, the son of a relative, perhaps, or of someone who had emigrated, who knows where. In the farmhouse, there was no shortage of room, or of work, either. It was not that my father was in need of a practical arrangement. He didn't lack a roof over his head. What he lacked was a family. And so it was that at 16 or 17 years old, he was always there, Saturdays and Sundays, and every day in the summer for the harvest, the winemaking, the hay-cutting, the wood-cutting in the forest. He liked to study, but he also liked the outdoor life. My mother told me about when they had challenged each other to press I don't know how many hundreds of kilos of grapes with their feet, of their youthful discovery of wine, and of the day they had been found hiding in the cellar completely drunk. There were so many anecdotes of this kind, she said, but she wanted to make one thing clear. This relationship did not begin and develop by chance. There was a specific mover behind it. The priest, the one from the mountain, who was a friend of my grandfather, had for years taken girls and boys camping, and had kept a keen eye on my father to see if he would bond with the others. My grandfather had in turn agreed to welcome this orphan into his own home. It would also be a way of providing for his future. Piero was similar to me, my mother said. He was taciturn, reflective.
He had a sensitivity that made him able to understand others, and which at the same time made him a bit vulnerable around anyone with a character stronger than his own. When the time came to go to university, he was in no doubt as to his choice of subject. He had always wanted more than anything else to become a doctor. And he would have made a good doctor, my mother said. He had what it took to be one, a talent for compassion and for listening. My father, on the other hand, was less interested in people than he was in the material world, in earth, fire, air, water. He liked the idea of being able to plunge his hands into its material components and to find out what they were made of. Yes, I thought, that was him all right. That was how I remembered him, fascinated by every grain of sand and crystal of ice, altogether indifferent to people. I could easily imagine the passion with which, at 19, he had embarked on his study of chemistry. In the meantime, he and Piero had begun to go into the mountains by themselves. Almost every Saturday, from June to September, they would take the bus for Trento or Belluno, then hitchhike back up the mountain. They spent the nights in meadows, or sometimes in a hayloft. They had no money with which to buy anything, but then neither did anyone else who went into the mountains in those days, my mother said. The Alps were a poor man's North Pole or Pacific Ocean, the destination of young people like them who were in search of adventure. Of the two, it was my father who studied the maps and planned new routes. Piero was more cautious, but also more obstinate. He was difficult to convince in the first place, but even more difficult to dissuade halfway, and was the ideal companion for my father, who had a tendency to give up as soon as things did not go according to plan. Then their paths in life diverged. The chemistry degree was shorter than the one in medicine. My father graduated first and in 67 went to do his military service. He ended up in the Alpine artillery, dragging cannon and mortar up the mule tracks of the Great War. His degree earned him the rank of NCO, or Sergeant of Mules, as he called it. He didn't spend much time in barracks that year, but spent almost the entire time moving from valley to valley with his company. He discovered that he did not dislike this kind of life at all. Whenever he came back, he seemed older, both in comparison to the young man who had left and to Piero, who was still spending whole days buried in his books. It was as if he had been the first to taste something harder and more real, and that he liked the taste. He had experienced, albeit in a grappa-induced fog, the long marches and encampments in the snow. And it was about the snow that he would talk to Piero when on leave. About its different forms, its mutable character, its language. In one of those bursts of enthusiasm to which he was prone as a young chemist, he had fallen in love with a new element. He would say that the mountain in winter was another world entirely, and that they should go there together. And so it was that during the Christmas of 68, soon after his discharge from the military, he and Piero inaugurated their first winter season. They managed to borrow from someone the skis and sealskins. They began by going again to the places they knew best, except that now, rather than staying out under the stars, they had to pay to sleep at the refuges. My father was super fit, my uncle much less so, since he had spent the last year preparing for his final exams. But he was as enthusiastic as my father about making new discoveries. They barely had enough money for food and board, let alone to employ an Alpine guide. So their technique was what it was. And in any case, according to my father, going up was just a question of having good legs, and you could always find a way of getting down. Little by little, they were even developing a style of their own. Until, that is, they decided to head in March for a fork of the Sassalungo, and found themselves crossing a slope in the afternoon sun. I could see vividly the scene that my mother was describing, however many times she must have told it before. My father was up ahead a short distance, and had removed his ski to prepare for the assault, when he felt the ground giving way beneath his feet. He heard a rustling, like the sound that a wave makes retreating over sand. And it really did seem as if the whole slope that they had just traversed was in the process of retreating downwards. Very slowly, at first, my father went down a meter, shifted to the side, and managed to grab hold of a rock, and watched his ski continue sliding on down. Piero, who had been on the steepest and smoothest part of the slope, was going down too. My father saw him lose his balance and slide on his belly, looking up, with his hands scrabbling for purchase that was not there. Then the bank of snow gathered speed and momentum. This was not the dry snow of winter which plummets in powdery clouds. It was the damp spring snow that goes down rolling, rolling and gathering until it encounters an obstacle, and it buried Piero with hardly an impact. It just went over him and continued its descent. 200 meters below, the slope flattened out, and it was only there that the avalanche stopped. Even before it had done so, my father ran down in search of his friend, but could not find him. Now the snow was hard, heavy snow compacted by the fall. He wandered on the avalanche, calling out, searching everywhere for any sign of movement. But the snow was completely still again, even though it was less than a minute since it had moved. In the months that followed, my father would tell it like this. It was as if some great beast had been disturbed in its sleep, merely growled and then shaken off its irritation before settling down to sleep again in a more comfortable place. As far as the mountain was concerned, nothing had happened. The only hope, something that happens in a few rare cases, was that Piero had created an air pocket beneath the snow in which he was still able to breathe. In any case, my father did not have a shovel, so he took the only sensible course of action open to him. He started towards the refuge where they had slept, only to find himself sinking in softer snow. So he turned round again, retrieved the one remaining ski, and managed somehow to get down with it. Despite sliding in short bursts and frequently falling, it was still much better than sinking at every step. He reached the refuge mid-afternoon and called the emergency services. By the time they got there, it was already dark, and they found my uncle the next morning, dead beneath a meter of avalanche, suffocated by the snow. It was immediately clear to everyone that it was all my father's fault. Who else could they have blamed? Two facts proved the extent to which they were badly underprepared for winter. They were ill-equipped and had been up there at completely the wrong time. It had recently snowed. It was far too warm to attempt the crossing of a slope. As the more experienced of the two, my father should have known this, should have avoided the crossing and been the first to retreat. My grandfather found something unforgivable in his mistakes, and rather than diminishing with time, his rage became more deeply rooted. He did not go so far as to shut my father from the house, but he was no longer pleased to see him, and his whole demeanor altered whenever he turned up. Then he started to avoid him. Even a year afterwards, at the memorial mass for his son, he made sure to sit on the other side of the church from him. At a certain point, my father gave up and ceased to disturb him. And it is precisely at this point in the story that my mother enters the stage, though in fact she had always been a part of it, albeit as a spectator. She had known my father for what seemed like a lifetime, even if at first she had merely thought of him as a friend of her brother. Then, gradually, he had become her friend as well. They had sung, drunk, walked, harvested grapes side by side together so many times that after the accident, they began to meet up to talk. My father was in a terrible state, and to my mother it did not seem fair. It did not seem fair that he had been given the blame for everything and then left alone to shoulder it. They ended up falling for each other, and about a year later they were married. The entire family refused their invitations to the wedding. So they were married without any relatives present, already prepared to leave for Milan where their lives would begin again, with a new house, new jobs, new friends, new mountains. I was also part of this new life. In fact, my mother said, this was what made sense of all the rest. I with my old-fashioned name. A family name. That was all. When my mother had finished her account, I thought about the glaciers, the way in which my father would speak about them to me. He was not one for retracing his own steps and did not like thinking again about unhappy times. But on certain occasions in the mountains, even on those virginal mountains where no friend had died, he would look at the glacier and something would resurface and come back to him. He put it like this, that the summer erases memories, just like it melts the snow. But the glacier is the snow of winters long past. It is a memory of winter that does not wish to be forgotten. Only now did I understand what he was talking about. And I knew once and for all that I had two fathers. The first had been the stranger with whom I had lived for 20 years in the city, and then burnt my bridges with for another 10. The second was my father as he was in the mountains, the one I had only glimpsed but still knew better than the first, the man who walked behind me on the paths, the lover of glaciers. This other father had left me a ruin to rebuild. so I decided to forget all about the first, and to complete that work to remember him by.
8. By August, we had finished the roof of the house. It was made up of two layers of planks separated by a metal sheet and insulation. On the outside, it was covered with shingles of larch, superimposed one over another and traversed by grooves down which the water could run off. Inside, there were matchboards made of spruce. The larch would protect the house from the rain. The spruce would retain the heat. We had decided not to make a hole in it for a skylight, so that even at the height of summer, the interior would be shaded. The north-facing windows received no direct light, but looking out of them, you could see the mountains in front of you, rising on the other side of the lake, shining almost white. Their outcrops of rock and scree were blinding in this season. The light which entered the windows came from there, as if from a mirror. This is how a house built on the reverse side works. I went outside to look at the far mountains in sunlight, then turned towards our own, the Grenon, which covered the sky on the other side. I wanted to climb to its top and see what Barma looked like from up there. It had been looming over me every day for 2 months, but I had not thought of doing this until now. I think that my legs themselves were fostering the desire in me, together with the heat of summer. They were restless again, having regained their strength, and the summer was drawing me towards the heights. Bruno came down from the roof, where he was working on a painstaking job. A layer of lead needed to be fixed between the rock face and the roof, so that the water draining down on rainy days would not find its way into the house. The lining needed to be molded one piece at a time with a hammer, so that it would follow and adhere to every hollow and protrusion. The lead was soft, and with careful work it looked in the end almost as if it had been soldered to the rock, or as if it were one of its own dark veins. In this way, the roof and the rock became a single surface. I asked Bruno about the path leading to the Grenon, and he pointed to a track that went up from the lake along the slope. It disappeared in a thicket of alder, crossed a swampy area, and reappeared further on between flounces of new grass. Behind there, he said, what looked like a ridge actually hid another basin, and another lake smaller than our own. From the lake onwards, it was all scree. There wasn't really a path to follow when climbing it, perhaps just a few piled stones indicating the way, or some track used by chamois. But in any case, he said, pointing to a notch in the crest of the summit where a residual snowfield stood out, by keeping my eye fixed on that snow, I couldn't go wrong. I'd like to take a trip up there, I said, on Saturday or Sunday, maybe, if it's sunny.
Why not go now? He said. I can do this on my own.
Are you sure?
Of course. Take a day off. Go on, go.
The lake higher up was different from ours. The last few Swiss pines and larch trees, the last clumps of willow and alder gradually disappeared from the slope, and beyond the ridge the rarefied air of the mountain already blew. The lake was only a greenish pool, surrounded by meager grazing and expanses of blueberries. 20 or so unattended goats were huddled near a ruin and ignored my presence, or almost. The path ended there, amongst the false trails made by the passage of cattle, where the threadbare grass gave way to slabs of scree. I could see clearly the snowfield up above, and I remembered my father's rules. I imagined a straight line between myself and the snow, and took it. I could hear his voice in my ears, saying, "Straight, go up this way." It had been a long time since I had walked above the tree line. I had never done so alone, but must have learned well as I still felt at ease moving across the scree. I would see a pile of stones up ahead and make directly for it, moving from stone to stone, instinctively choosing the largest and most stable and avoiding the unstable ones. I felt a kind of give from the rocks, which did not absorb your step like earth or grass, but returned some of the force to your legs, enhancing your momentum. So as soon as I had placed a foot on a stone and pushed my weight forwards and upwards, the other foot began to move forwards too, and I soon found myself running and leaping across the scree, almost ceding control to my legs and letting them do the work for me. I felt that I could trust them, and that I could not go wrong. I remembered the joy that my father showed as soon as we had left behind the alpine meadows and entered into the world of rock, the same joy that I felt now, coursing through my own body. When I reached the small snowfield, I was breathing heavily from the run. I stopped to touch that August snow. It was icy and granular, so hard that you needed to scrape it with your nails, and I gathered together a handful to wipe over my forehead and neck to cool myself down. I sucked on it until I felt my lips sting, then climbed across the last section of scree up to the crest. Now the view opened up for me on the other side of the Grainon, the side that was in the sun, where beneath my feet, after a section of rock, a long meadow sloped gently down to a group of huts and to a grazing dotted by cattle. It seemed as if I had suddenly descended 1,000 meters, or had found myself in another season. In front of me, the full light of summer and the sound of the lively cattle. Behind me, when I looked back, a shadowy, somber autumn of damp rock and patches of snow. From up here, the two lakes were twinned by the perspective. I looked for the house that Bruno and I were building, but perhaps I was too high up, or perhaps it was too well blended in to be distinguished from the mountain that supplied the material from which it was made. The piles of stone markers continued beneath the ridge, along a good ledge. But I felt like climbing, and seeing no great difficulties ahead of me, decided to reach the summit this way. For the first time in years, I placed my hand on the rock, selected footholds, and heaved myself up. Although it was an easy climb, the old maneuvers demanded my complete concentration. I had to think again about exactly where to place each hand and foot, using balance rather than force, trying to stay light. I soon lost all sense of time. I was oblivious to the surrounding mountains and to the two contrasting worlds that plummeted beneath me. Only the rock face directly in front of me existed, only my feet and my hands, until I reached a point at which it was impossible to climb further, and only then did I realize that I was at the summit. Now what? I thought. There was a mound of stones on the crest. Beyond this rudimentary monument, Monte Rosa had appeared, its glaciers outlined against the sky. Perhaps I should have had a beer with me with which to celebrate, but feeling neither exultation nor relief, I decided to stay only as long as it would take to smoke a cigarette, bid farewell to my father's mountain, and then head back down. I still knew how to recognize each one of the peaks. I observed them while smoking, from east to west, and remembered all of their names. I wondered how high I'd reached, and thinking that I must have passed the 3,000-meter mark without any adverse effects on my stomach, I began to look around for any marker giving the altitude. I saw that jammed into a mound of stones, there was a metal box. I knew immediately what would be inside. I opened the lid and found a notebook inside a plastic bag, which had not wholly succeeded in protecting it. Its ruled pages had the texture of paper that had dried after getting wet. There were also a couple of pens inside, with which those rare climbers to this point had left a thought, or sometimes just a name and date. The last entry had been made over a week ago. I leafed through its pages and saw that no more than 10 people a year had climbed this barren mountain, which cast its shadow over my house and which I already thought of as mine, and that its record of these climbers therefore went back over many years. I read many names and hardly impressive comments. It seemed to be the case that after so much exertion, nobody could find the words with which to express what they felt. Those who tried left only some poetic or spiritual banality. I leafed backwards through the notebook, somewhat irritated by humankind, and did not know what I was looking for until I found it. 2 lines from 1997. I recognized the handwriting, and the spirit behind the words. He had written, "Climbed up from Grana in 3 hours and 58 minutes. Still in great shape. Giovanni Guasti." I spent a long time staring at my father's words. The ink blurred by water, the signature less legible than the two phrases that preceded it. It was the signature of a man who had been used to signing his name frequently, no longer really a name, just an automatic gesture. Concentrated into the exclamation mark was all the good humor that he had felt that day. He had been alone, or so it seemed from the notebook, and so I imagined him climbing over the scree and coming out on the summit just as I had done. I was sure that he must have been keeping an eye on the time, and that at some point he must have started to hurry. He would have wanted at all costs to get there in under 4 hours. He felt good up there at the top, proud of the strength of his legs and elated to see his luminous mountain again. I thought of tearing out the page to keep, but then it seemed as sacrilegious as taking away a stone from the summit. I carefully wrapped the notebook in plastic, placed it back inside the box, and left it there. In the weeks that followed,